remind you about the Noether and Goldstone theorems. And then the toy model was an example where the massless particle had special properties because it was a Goldstone boson, but it was a especially simple one because it was an abelian symmetry. So I want to do the non-abelian case. And then we'll talk a little bit about what happens if it's a gauge symmetry rather than a global symmetry that we're talking about. And this is kind of historically where a lot of this formalism came from, because back in the 60s, people were trying to understand pions and kaons and mesons and QC in the strong interaction sector. And it became clear at some point that a lot of their properties could be thought of as symmetry properties, and they were behaving in many ways like Goldstone bosons, but not quite. So they were called pseudo-Goldstone bosons. So they were the Goldstone bosons for something which wasn't an exact symmetry, but was an approximate symmetry of the strong interactions. And then with the discovery of QCD, there was an understanding as to where the symmetries came from. But in the old days, they would calculate the properties of pions kind of fairly laboriously using what they called the current algebra, which was essentially using symmetry arguments and the conserved currents that come with symmetries. And it was realized in the 60s that a much more efficient way to do that is to write down an effective field theory, essentially. And that was kind of the beginning, yeah, thanks. That was the beginning of the systematization of this low energy approximation. And I gather, you know, I wasn't around, but I gather that in the 60s, quantum field theory people didn't think quantum field theory was the way to go. And so the people who were thinking about effective field theories as ways to think about currents and symmetry consequences were in the minority. But their point of view, I think, prevailed in the end of the day. And their point of view was that essentially writing a field theory has almost no content. It's just quantum mechanics and relativity and unitarity and basic things like that. And so if you can capture the physics you're trying to describe in a general field theory, you've actually lost no generality in doing that. And I think Weinberg is probably the person that you attribute most of this stuff to in the 60s. But then it was developed by many people since then. The funny thing was, so the main ideas and the basic framework for Goldstone bosons was set up in the 60s. And the main result I'm going to talk about was by Coleman, Callan, Wesson, Zimino. But the systematization of the properties of pions and QCD actually didn't happen until the early 80s. And I remember as a graduate student seeing those papers and thinking, well, that was done 20 years ago. And it turns out it hadn't been done 20 years ago, but the ideas were there, but no one had actually sat down and worked out the details. And So I remember at the time thinking that would have been a good project for a graduate student. Goldstone. I normally would say Goldstone bosons, but really it's Goldstone particles because if we had been talking about supersymmetry, all the words go through, but in this case, that case, it's a fermion. So I want to first remind you the background is I want to remind you of Noether's theorem and the symmetries. And the symmetry conserved current link, and then the Goldstone theorem. And then the next thing will be the nonlinear realizations of symmetries. And if you're looking for where in the notes I'm working from, I'm mostly working at this point from these. It's again one of the articles I gave at the very beginning. It's called Goldstone and Pseudo-Goldstone Bosons in Nuclear Particle and Condensed Matter Physics. So I'm doing the chapter two of that, basically. Those notes also go on and do non-relativistic examples, like spin waves, which is also interesting because particularly ferromagnetic spin waves, spins are kind of the classic particle physics example of spontaneous symmetry breaking, which is what this is about. But it turns out that ferromagnets are are not the ones that are behaving the way particle physics systems normally behave, because in ferromagnets you break time reversal invariance. And so it turns out the effect of Lagrangian in that case, the leading time derivative is actually a one time derivative rather than two. So there's a similar story to what I'm going to say here. But in the ferromagnet case, and specifically the details of how the symmetry gets realized, is a little bit different. But it's also in those notes. Okay. All right, so let's start off with symmetries and conservation laws. So the basic thing in quantum mechanics is that, you know, we know that on the one hand you've got time evolution is described by unitary evolution. So you'd have some state that tells you what it's doing at later times. And normally we would imagine U to be the exponential of the Hamiltonian, T minus T naught, let's say. But if you have a symmetry, the idea is that you've got some transformation that is not changing probabilities. And so it's being described in the Hilbert space by a unitary transformation, unitary or anti-unitary. There's a theorem underlying all this, Wigner's theorem. And so that says that there's some sort of a transformation, let's call it G, which is unitary, so G, so let's say, so transformations of states, the assumption is that G, it's a family of transformations like this, G, so I say do not change probabilities. And that means that G inverse will be G dagger, or it could also be anti-unitary. It's only anti-unitary if it flips the sign of the Hamiltonian. So essentially, time reversal is the anti-unitary option. I said that wrong. I'm going to argue that this thing now is going to commute with U, but if it's changing in time reversals, in the case of time reversal, what happens is that the time is, you know, t is going to minus t, and so that the way, if g had been unitary, the way that would work is that you'd also have h going to minus h, but the Hamiltonian is supposed to be bounded from below. That's one of the things you demand. It's supposed to be, there's supposed to be some ground state, and so the anti-unitary loophole is the way in which you arrange for probabilities not to change, and also not to change the sign of the Hamiltonian. But apart from time reversal, essentially, it's always going to be unitary. And it's unitary because you're asking that inner products in the Hilbert space not change, because you're not trying to change probabilities. And this is supposed to be true at any time. So in particular, it means that you can think of chi at a later time t. If I have two states that are related by the symmetry at some time and I evolve them forward in time, then I'm expecting that they're still related by the symmetry. So I've got two ways to think of this. It's going to be either the evolution in time of chi, which is the evolution in time times g on the original state, psi, or I could equivalently think of it as being I act with g on psi of t, which I then got by evolving in time. So the symmetry idea normally tells you that G is commuting with U. And what's nice about it is that the same way, so far so good. Now it's typically true also that if you have two things that have the property that they're not changing physics, then if you multiply them, you've got another thing which is satisfying the same property. So the collection of g's that satisfy this property form a group, So if I have G1 and G2, both symmetries in that sense, then G1 and G2, call that G3, is also. There's also a transformation which doesn't do anything. That's the, that not doing anything, like the unit matrix does this. So if you track it through, then this is, it's also true that you want the, it's states are not being destroyed by G. So this, the G's, as you, if you think about what their properties are forming a group. So the collection of G's form a group. And we're particularly interested in the case where the G's, there's a continuous family of G's, so that it's not just some discrete set of them. So thinking of them, I'm thinking of rotations. You could rotate through any angle, translations. So in that case, so if G is parameterized by a bunch of continuous labels, it's a continuous family. And part of this is differentiable, and there's, if I was a mathematician, I'd give you more. I'll do the physicist thing that I'll differentiate it whenever I want to, and then in the end of the day, I'll have assumed that I could do that. Is it continuous? Is labeled by continuous parameter set, which is what you would call the Lie group. Then we can start differentiating these G's with respect to theta, and then you won't be surprised to think that it's useful, or you can define for every unitary thing, it's continuous in this way, a Hermitian thing like the analog of the Hamiltonian. So we can define, in this case, Q's to be something like G inverse dG d theta, and we'd have one for every parameter. So G is going to look like e to the I theta alpha Q alpha, let's say, where Q will be Hermitian because G inverse is equal to G dagger. And I tell you this because this leads to this, you know, in quantum mechanics, you're allowed to label states with the eigenvalues of Hermitian operators because they're real, and they, you can use a mutually commuting set at label simultaneously. You can use a mutually commuting set to simultaneously label states. And what's nice about these Q's is that now you have a Hermitian thing which you're guaranteed has the property that it's going to commute with the Hamiltonian because of this. So GU equals UG is going to turn into the statement that HQ is equal to QH. So eigenvalues of Q can be used to label energy eigenstates. And they're conserved in the sense that if Q on psi is equal to Q on psi, then Q on psi at some later time is Q times U of T on psi, which because they commute is, so I'm kind of beating you over the head with the things I think you know already. So that means that these quantities are, these are conserved quantum numbers. And that's great because you didn't need to be able to solve anything to know that what was conserved, whatever you start off with, you end up with, and that's always a great thing when you're doing physics because there's so few things you know as exact statements. So far so good, and that's all true in quantum mechanics. What about field theory? What's special about field theory is that our Hamiltonian is coming to us as the integral over space of a Hamiltonian density, and so what'll happen is that our charges will also come to us as integrals of charge densities, and so there's a similar story in field theory, and the new thing is that you don't just get a charge, you get a conserved current. I should have also said here that before I leave the quantum mechanics case, states are being related by G, And I could also think of operators as being, you know, you always have the freedom to think about whether or not you're going to imagine states being transformations amongst states or transformations amongst the operators. But if the states are transforming in the way they were, operators under the symmetry are transform under the symmetry as, you know, some operator will go to G times the operator times G dagger. And that has the property that those operators, if they transform that way, the states transform this way, all expectation values and correlation functions of operators don't change. And if I did an infinitesimal transformation where I imagine doing a very small change where G was 1 plus I times theta times Q, this would mean that for infinitesimal transformations, O goes to O, you know, 1 plus I theta Q plus dot dot dot, O 1 minus I theta Q plus dot dot dot. So that's equal to O plus I theta commutator of Q with O plus order theta squared. I'm telling you that because I want to use these properties later on for currents as well. The analog. When I show you the currents, I want to argue that the charges do this, have this property that you commute them with things and you get the transformation laws of those things. And that was something which is true for quantum mechanics already. Okay, so for field theory, so now we're doing Noether's theorem. For local field theories, symmetries don't just give you charges, give conserved charges. They give conserved currents. That's to say that not only is the sum of all charges everywhere in the universe conserved, it's locally conserved. If you take charge in some region, if you change the charge in that region, the only way you could have done it is you have to physically move it out of the region or into the region. It can't appear or disappear everywhere locally. So there's more information in this local conservation.
The thing in the middle is an operator O and the thing.
Yeah, this O and theta looks a lot alike, doesn't it? Yeah. Okay, so what's the argument for that? So the argument is that in field theory, here we were talking about symmetries in that they commute with time evolution, but in field theory, the dynamics is coming from the action. And so a symmetry is something which leaves the action unchanged. In field theory, before I say that, I should say also say here, we have conserved quantum numbers, but we also have the property that if I have two states supposing I have a symmetry that changes, that is not diagonalized. Second property of symmetries that's useful is that if I have two states, say chi and psi, that are related by the action of Q, let's say that that was true. Then the fact that Q commutes with H implies that the energy, if these are energy eigenstates, the energy of chi will be the energy of psi. That's the other useful thing about symmetry. So if you have a bunch of states that are related by a symmetry, like spin states or something, and that symmetry, and if you're in a rotationally invariant problem, then you're guaranteed that all those states that are related by the symmetry have exactly the same energy. So these are the two kind of great things about symmetries. And we're going to be interested in to what extent these things go over to the case of a symmetry in field theory. So symmetry in field.
I think the opposite is also correct for Noether theorem.
The opposite.
For every conserved quantum theory is a symmetry.
I'm just trying to think if
so
I can.
For example, in conformality theory, then you have sketch invariance. People claim that there's also conformal invariance. I mean, the special conformal transformation invariance, and then.
Yeah. That's only recently been established, right? If I understand that right. That I'm just trying to think if there's some stupid example I can make where I just I take a free field theory and it's quite likely true. I can't. That's no counterexamples are coming to mind, but I'm worried there might be some stupid thing I could make up that.
Well, I don't know if this isn't really a counterexample. Yeah. There are times you have considered quantities in like just not field theories, but just like particle, just like one particle type of motion that's not coming from a symmetry of the Lagrangian. The example I'm thinking of is when you're in Kerr, there's a conserved quantity that's not a symmetry of the Lagrangian. It's like the Carter constant. It sort of, it just doesn't come from, because there's only two symmetries, I guess.
I do think in flat space.
Okay, well, I'm just saying the motion of a particle in a Kerr spacetime is some Lagrangian, can be described by just some Lagrangian for the thing. So I guess it would be conceivable that there's these other weird symmetries that are, or these conserved quantities, but I don't know. I don't have an explicit example.
Okay, I don't know that example, so I don't know. I can't comment on it really. But you're saying that there's a, so it should be describable in the sense that it's field theory on Kerr spacetime should fit into this framework. So. So the Carter thing is an example.
There's a Chilling tensor in Kerr. So
oh, okay, I didn't know that.
That gives you the Carter constant. And so it's not, so Chilling tensors don't involve these one parameter continuous deformations of your space time. It just, but they always, so people sometimes talk about how they're higher, or if you do a Hamiltonian framework, there's a higher order symmetry somehow, where it's not linear in moment or something.
Okay.
So that, I don't know if that would be directly applicable, and I don't have an example where it feels very good.
Yeah. Okay, so I think fair answer is we don't know. But I'd like to learn about that example, actually. It's always the outliers that you want to look at, because those are the ones that are going to teach you something, right? All right, asymmetry. So I want to define it to be, it's a transformation of the fields. So let's say we have a bunch of fields phi I, and I give you some rule, some functions of phi, and there may be some parameters here. So let me use omega rather than theta as a parameter, just so I don't have this proper problem that I had over there with operators looking like theta. So this is a parameter, infinitesimal parameter, and this is just some function which we could. In specific examples will be specific things, but it's not going to play a role in what I'm going to do here. What you want it to be is you want these transformations to be invertible, so you don't want to, because, but that's probably all I'm going to use here for this, for the properties of C. Proper fields for which the action is invariant. Action, which is, you know, the integral d4x of the Lagrangian density, built out of phi and its derivatives, so on, is invariant. And so what we want to do is we want to do a similar kind of story here and drive the currents, but drive them as the integrals of over space-time. And so the idea is that what we're going to do is we're going to start off assuming that omega is a constant. So for a global symmetry, omega A is constant in space-time. And for a gauge symmetry, we'd come back and we'd relax that. A equals omega A of x. But I'm going to focus on this for the Goldstone theorem. And later on, what we'll do is we'll come back and we'll gauge the symmetry by promoting it to a local thing, and we'll talk about just a little bit at the end what happens in that case. All right. So the Noether's theorem proceeds from this starting point. And so the expression, so the, and it's just, it's one of these things where we just do it. So we just write out the condition that this be invariant under that transformation. So we want to ask that the variation of the action to be zero is the same thing as asking that the variation of the Lagrangian be the divergence of something for some v mu. Because if this is true, then when I integrate it to get the action, this will integrate to some surface things. And as long as those surface things are not changing, or as long as I can ignore surface things, then we're good. And whether you can kind of divide like what you might call a space-time, this is kind of a fuzzy definition, but a space-time transformation is one for which v mu is not zero, and then an internal symmetry is one for which v mu is equal to zero. So it may or may, you know, someone hands you a symmetry, you can do the variation of Lagrangian, see whether or not this is true, whether the Lagrangian was straight invariant, in which case v would be zero, or if the Lagrangian changed, but it changed by total derivative, in which case v is a space-time transformation. So, and the name is coming because the usual internal symmetries we talk about, like electromagnetic charge or something, for them v would be zero, but for translations or rotations or supersymmetry transformations, this would be non-zero. So it's normally it's the things that are moving you around in space-time that are making the v's not zero. Not always, but it's usually that's true. If you look at the example of the spin wave in a ferromagnet, it actually also has, it's an example where you have something like this going on. And there's a sense in which it's a space-time transformation in that case. So far, definition. So now what we have to do is just write out what the transformation rule is, given that that's how the phi's transform. And so what we just do is we vary all the phi's in here. And so if we evaluate what the variation of L is, it'll be, we vary, you know, a piece will come from varying the fields. And then the variation of the fields will be given by how the fields transform. So this, remember, was what delta phi was. And then if we have derivatives of the fields, we'll have the variation of the derivatives of the fields times the variation of the derivative of the field, which will be the derivative of this. And because omega is a constant, we can pull the omega out. And that's the thing that's supposed to be equal to the divergence of V. And let me put it, there should have been, if I have several parameters, this transformation should have been proportional to the infinitesimal transformation parameter. So let me define V with this thing scaled out. And the important thing is that this is, if this is a symmetry, what it means to be a symmetry is that this is an identity. This is identically true. Identity for all omega A and all phi I. So it's not like you choose a configuration where this is true. You take a random configuration and you do this variation and it's always true. That's what we mean by the symmetry. So now the proof of the theorem is you do the usual thing where you integrate this, write this thing as a total derivative of d mu of something minus the derivative on this side. So we're going to essentially integrate by parts. And that d mu of something we can put on this side of the equation. So let's do that. We have, and also, since this is true for all omega, I can cancel the omegas because it wasn't like it wasn't like this is just true if omega 1 and omega 2 were related in one way. The statement of the symmetry is that for any omega, I can turn on an omega and I can vary them separately, and this is true for each of them because it's an identity. So I don't have to keep track of the omegas. So what's left will be this statement. Now if I write this as a total derivative minus the derivative on the other side, I'll have, let me start with the minus the derivative of the other side. Times CAI. And that'll be equal to d mu of v mu And then what I've done is I've written this as the total derivative here, so I have to subtract that from this side, and that'll be dl times right. So this is true for all phi I. Now, what you're supposed to recognize is that this is the equation of motion. This equals zero is the classical equation of motion. And so Noether's theorem states that when you solve the equations of motion, so this side is zero, then you've got a vector whose property that has the property that its divergence is zero. The symmetry guarantees that statement. And that's the thing we're looking to prove, because that's the statement that there's a conserved current. So symmetry plus equation of motion implies there exists a J mu, one for each symmetry, such that the divergence of J mu is equal to zero. And the J mu is given to you constructively, and it's that V mu minus dl d mu phi I times CAI. So the existence, it's not just that it exists, here it is. Where did that come from? It came because what I did is, the step I didn't write explicitly was I wrote that as the derivative of something minus the derivative on this side. Minus d mu of thing times c. And so this derivative I put over on this side, and that was this. You're right, yeah, this c should not be inside anymore, right? Thank you. Yeah, so this is the equation of motion times CAI. Thank you. This may be expensive. I don't think I have any coins. Ah, there's coins. Today it's a dime. Right. Okay. So far, so good. And what's not clear yet is why this is local current. This is current conservation. And so the connection between this statement and current conservation is that if we define Q, and I'm calling it Q because it's going to be the Q over there, to be the integral d3x of J0, we'll have one for each symmetry. Or if we're doing this covariantly, what we could have done is we would have said that Q would be the integral over some spatial hypersurface of d sigma mu the normal times J mu A. Then the statement is that this thing, I'm writing this as a surface of constant time. So this in principle could have been a function of time. But it's not a function of time because of this equation. So that if I take Q at one time and I subtract from it Q at a different time, this equation allows me to write the difference as the integral of the divergence of J, and that divergence will be zero. So I'll be able to derive that the difference between Q of T and Q of T prime is zero. So the claim I'm trying to make is that div J equals zero is the same statement as Q of T is independent of T. So we take, so what we do is we take a slice at here's T, here's T prime, and so we take Q of T minus Q of T prime. So that'll be the integral. Actually, let me do it differently. Let me prove actually slightly stronger statement. Let me take some region, call it region R, And let me define q inside that region as a function of time to be the integral over that region, you know, d3x of j0. I want to put the r in here just to emphasize that it depends now on the region I've used. So now if I calculate the rate of change of this, of q sub a for the region, well, as long as the boundaries of the region don't change in time, so the integration limits don't change, then the derivative of this vector time will be all to do with the derivative of the integrand. So we'll have integral r d3x of dj dt. But this equation here says that dj0 plus the divergence of the vector part of j is 0. If I wrote that out in terms of space and time. So if I use this here, this is just minus the integral for r of d3x of div j a. And then by Gauss's law, this is minus the integral over the boundary of r, d2x of the normal dot j. So this is kind of the way to see local current conservation. This is saying that the rate of change of the charge in here is completely given by the flux of the current through the surface. So that you know, if this is a little piece of the surface, there's a normal element. And what we're doing is we're taking the current j at every point, dotting it with the normal to get the piece that's point the flow of current out, summing it up over the whole boundary. And so this is physically saying that the only way you can change the charge in here is to physically move it across the boundary. It's not going to change spontaneously in here. This is like economics if there's no growth in your economy. If you want to get money in or out of a country, you have to move it across the border. So this is kind of why we're talking about conservation. And so in particular, for this original picture I had where we did all of space and there's no borders, then this integral would be 0 because there's nothing, no boundary to put it across. And then that would say that dq dt is 0. So q would be fixed for every time. Well, I've just shown you that I've shown you that a symmetry has produced a conserved charge, because I just proved that it was conserved.
Yeah, but you also
right. Right. Well, so you knew that you had to get a conserved charge, but now I've given it to you. I've shown you that conserved charge is the integral of something. So the new thing is that you've got a J that you didn't.
You don't know.
It could be that there's two charges for every symmetry. So what you could do is you could take the q that you get here, and you could take the q you get here, and you could check, are they the same? And they are. What's what?
I'm saying you have a tower of q's, right? Small q's. They're the same, the eigenvalues of
the eigenvalues of q, okay, yeah. No, A was the thing that went with, you have a several parameter family of symmetries. Omega was the thing that was what I was calling theta at one point. It's the small parameter. So if you have an N parameter symmetry group, A would be going from 1 to N. So for rotations of 3 dimensions, A would be going from 1 to 3, say. For each symmetry, this gives you a Q that's conserved, yeah. In what sense do you have enough of my Qs? Well, the quantum number I got by saying that I had a symmetry, and then I had this is omega, right? So for every symmetry, I could differentiate with this. For every parameter of symmetries, every parameter's worth of symmetries, I could differentiate it and get from the unitary thing a Hermitian thing. And so for every parameter in that sense, I've got somebody whose eigenvalues you can count. And so for every parameter in that same sense, I've got a Hermitian thing whose eigenvalues you can count. I think So A is the same in both these things. I guess I called it alpha there. That was probably what. It's just labeling the number of parameters you had in your problem. So. Yep. If we do this, you can read it either way. So you can think of this being a classical story, or you could think. So if I set up the operator language, if I set up the operators in a language where they solve an equation, the classical equation of motion. So the simplest way to do that would be to use the interaction picture, say, where the operators are satisfying the free equation of motion, and the states are evolving with the interaction Hamiltonian or something like that. Because then the field equations are linear, so the issues of how you take products of operators is not coming into the field equations. But in that language, the same argument is true. So the whoever's action you vary to get the field equations, if it's got a symmetry, then you've got an operator that's conserved in this exact sense.
So this in your idea is the exponentiation and some parameters back to the generator there. That Q is the same Q as the one you define.
Yeah. Yeah. So you knew for quantum mechanics in general that if you have a symmetry, every parameter will give you a Hermitian thing that's conserved. And I'm just showing you that in the field theory, the new information is that symmetry, that generator, was the integral of something. So you actually have a local statement of conservation, whereas before, all you really knew was that the total charge, if you had a state, its eigenvalue wasn't changing, but it wasn't telling you locally what's going on. This is telling you in much more detail. It's saying that in every region, the conservation is that if you change the charge in the region, you have to actually physically move it across the boundary, as opposed to just a global statement of what's happening everywhere at once. Yeah, that's how you set it up normally, yeah.
But you still need to have a symmetry of the whole Lagrangian for this to go through.
Well, what would happen there would be that if you just did it for the free Lagrangian, then you'd have, it wouldn't be so useful. You'd have the free evolution would be, the operators, because they're evolving in a free way, there's lots of conserved things you can build out of that. But then the states, if you ask what the states are doing, the states wouldn't be doing anything nice unless it was also a symmetry of the interacting part of the Lagrangian.
Oh, so if it's a symmetry of the interacting part,
because the interacting picture is a full evolution, but you have the freedom as to how you always have this freedom, like the Schrodinger versus the Heisenberg evolution, as to whether or not the states are evolving and the operators are evolving. And the interaction picture splits it to make the operators evolving with the right. Yeah. So the whole evolution is there, but you're putting some of it on the operators, some of it on the states. And so you don't have to do that. You could do this in the Heisenberg picture where it's the operators that carry all the motion. But then the subtlety would be, you have to be careful about exactly what you mean by the equations of motion if it involves products of operators at some point, because those are singular things. So if you define that, then you can track this argument through using those definitions. But it's a subtlety I didn't want to go into. But it is true that the two things we want to use is that this thing is going to have the property that it's changing states under the symmetry. And if I take the commutator of Q with a field, the operators that are count in the field theory are the fields. And so wherever I wrote that, the analog of this statement for the fields would be that we said that delta phi was equal to omega A C I of phi. In the field theory, that would have come to us in the same way as being I times omega A commutator of this Q with phi. And so if you take simple examples, like just you do phase rotations or something in a quantum mechanical system, if you go through the exercise of constructing what the current is, you know, you're varying. If I took a free theory where the Lagrangian was d mu phi, or say it was the interactions are all on a potential, so the Lagrangian is d phi plus potential, then this just sees the kinetic term, and this is basically d mu phi, and so the time component of it is going to be phi dot, and so that's essentially the canonical momentum for that field. And so you can kind of see what's going on here is that if I take Q, it's the integral of the canonical momentum, and I take its commutator, the canonical momentum with the field is going to be giving me back the. So what I'm doing is if I take the example to show you how this is work, I'll take an example of L, which is minus 1/2 or minus d mu phi star d d mu phi minus v of phi star phi, let's say. That has a symmetry under which delta phi is equal to I omega phi, which is just phase rotations, right? So if I did this exercise over here, this is the Lagrangian's invariant. Delta L is equal to 0, so V is 0. This piece here would have been, so the current would have been, I take the derivative, the minus sign cancels the minus sign. I should be also keeping track of phi star. And I'm going to get something like, if I vary phi star, I'll get minus, thank you, phi star. Just let me, not fair to change things before I finish writing. So it's, so if I take phi star, I have d mu phi, I'll have minus I phi star plus I d mu phi star phi. Right? So that means j0 will be minus I, and then this is an upper time. So in flat space, say that would be plus I phi dot phi star minus I phi star dot phi. But the canonical momentum would have been delta action delta phi dot, which in this case, this is just phi dot star phi dot plus other things. So this is for phi, this would have been phi star dot, and so the complex conjugate would have been phi dot. And so you see what you're getting here is basically canonical momentum times the transformation rule of the field. So if I plug this into here, and I write this as I omega times the integral d3x of j0 times phi, you can see what's going to happen is that the commutator of the momentum with the field is going to give me a delta function. That'll do the integral. I'm left with the transformation rule of the field. So that's kind of how you'd see that this is doing what it's supposed to do. It's giving you the transformations of the fields. So if you doubted me that this is the same charge, this would be how you'd show it, right? You just take this thing, commute it with the fields, and see, am I getting the transformation rules? And that's kind of the way it would play out. So that's important. Yeah. So it's important. This is important that the you commute these things with the fields, you get the transformation rules. And it acts on the states. But there are subtleties that come from the fact that the charge is the integral of something. So I'm going to come back to those points later on when we talk about. So we haven't so far talked about spontaneous symmetry breaking. So spontaneous symmetry breaking that's the situation where Goldstone bosons arrive. You know, in our toy example, we had a complex field. We had this symmetry here, where you rotate the field by a phase. But then the vacuum was the potential was designed so that the field was not zero in the vacuum. And so that meant that the vacuum was not invariant under the symmetry, because the field was not zero. If you did a phase rotation, you kind of moved around. We had a Mexican hat potential. And we are minimized for some non-zero value, and then the symmetry kind of took you around the bottom of the potential. But in particular, the vacuum was not invariant, and that's kind of the defining feature of spontaneous symmetry breaking. So this is when the ground state is not invariant under the symmetry. So G acting on the ground state. The ground state is the minimum energy. And let's call it omega. So this is not equal to omega. Or another way of saying that would be that the charge acting on the vacuum is not equal to zero. And this is something which should be bizarre. If you came out of a quantum mechanics class, you would be surprised to have this happen, because that never happens in any of the quantum mechanics examples, right? The harmonic oscillator had a unique ground state, or the hydrogen atom has a unique ground state. For finite degrees of freedom, typically there's a unique ground state. If you set things up so that there's a double well like this, then what happens is that there's always tunneling between the two states, which splits makes the symmetric one have a little bit lower energy than the non-symmetric one. So you're always led to the place in quantum mechanics where the vacuum is unique. And because it's unique, if there's a symmetry, since the symmetry cannot change the energy, if you have the lowest energy state is unique, it has to be that symmetry leaves it unchanged. So it should feel wrong to have this be possible. And what happens in a field theory is that it becomes possible because effectively you've got so many degrees of freedom that although the vacuum is not unique, there's lots of every mode of the field is a new state that has a tunnel. And if there's a tunneling rate for every mode of the field, if you have to tunnel an infinite number of things to get over to distinguish the upper from the lower state, if essentially the tunneling rate, the total tunneling rate becomes zero because there's just too many things have to tunnel. And so what happens in a field theory is that the vacua that you could have built around any one of these the Hilbert spaces you would have built around any one of these vacua, they're inequivalent to one another in that you're not there's not the splitting. If you made a field theory into a quantum mechanical system by putting it in a box and cutting it off so there's a large but finite number of states, there would be a unique ground state, but it's so small, the splitting of it from the other states is so small that that the time it would take to tunnel from here to the vacuum is longer than any of the timescales of interest. So in practice, for a ferromagnet, even though there's a finite number of degrees of freedom, once you have several hundred or several thousand atoms, in practice, it will choose a minimum which is not symmetric, even though technically one of those states is lower than all the other ones.
So if you have a finite degrees of freedom, it's always...
In principle, it's always true that it's like the quantum mechanical statement that you pay for every node in your wave function. So the one that has no nodes is the one that's always got the less energy. I mean, just like take a spin state and then say the Hamiltonian is one.
starting with something trivial and maybe working way up to where it's...
Yeah, no, I'm sure you can make trivial examples like that. But if you're looking at the solutions to the Schrodinger equation, that's where the states, the exact parameters of the boundaries of the theorem, I don't know if I could clearly give it to you right now, but it's essentially true that if you take the node counting for wave functions makes it that it's typically true when you're solving the Schrodinger equation in position space. You solve it any way you like, but Schrodinger equation formulated where position is one of your variables, it's the typical thing is the ground state is unique because of the fact that tunneling will always, if you had two things that were separated by a barrier but were otherwise equal energy, there's always some small amplitude for them to talk to each other and then split. Yeah, supposing the ammonia atom is the simplest one, right? It's the one you always talk about where you have NH3. And then there's another way, these H's could be on this side too. And so the energy for that is one of these wells where it's degenerate. This state and this state are the same size. And so you never talk about the ammonia atom like you do in a field theory that you're here. You never say, well, I'm just here and that actually they're all on this side and they're not on this side. What's really going on is that there's a state which is the symmetric combination of this, that's the ground state. And there's another state which is the anti-symmetric combination, which has got a little bit more energy, and that's not the ground state. And so if someone hands you an ammonia atom, it's actually in this superposition of the two sides. And that's what always happens in quantum mechanics. So you could have said in a field theory, when I did the Higgs thing, why didn't we do that? Why didn't we really have the Higgs kind of smeared in some way that it wasn't actually in a field eigenstate? Why did we choose field eigenstates? Because that's what normally would happen in quantum mechanics. And the reason that you're allowed to even think about it is that the tunneling between all these states, there's so many modes that would have to tunnel that the tunneling is negligible in practice. But that doesn't tell you, that just says that you had the option of being at a field eigenstate. It doesn't tell you that you should be at a field eigenstate. And the argument that tells you that you should be in a field eigenstate is cluster decomposition. It says if you're requiring probabilities to factorize. If you take a system and you divide it into two subsystems, and you're requiring them, if you take points that are far apart from each other, they should essentially not know about each other. Then probability should factorize. That's called cluster decomposition, and that in field theory would be the statement that correlation functions of fields are falling off to zero as you separate them. And if you say that, if you apply that to the vacuum state, then if you imagine taking a correlation function say this is V1 and V2 or something. you know, phi of x, phi of y, v2, minus the expectation value, let's say, phi, phi. The thing that you want to have fall off to zero, in order for it, if you chose a state which was a superposition, this wouldn't fall off to zero. But it's when these guys are field eigenstates that the correlation functions are going to fall off to zero, and that's kind of why systems cluster, they choose the states that are field eigenstates, even though they had the option of choosing something else because there are so many degrees of freedom involved. And so that's why clustering is such an important property. The nature of clusters. You give me a shitload of atoms, you can entangle them if you want, but you have to work at it. What they want to do is they want to cluster. So they want to have things just be independent of each other. And that's kind of why local field theories are working, because you know, one of the things you demand is that if things cluster at initial times, the time evolution doesn't screw that up. And it doesn't, because it's the Hamiltonian comes to you as a sum over independent positions of what's moving you forward into the future. And because it was e to the I sum of things, the probabilities are all going to factorize in future times if they factorize at initial times. And so that's kind of built right in from the get-go in field theories. And it's not just field theories. Field theories are a good description of, you know, 80,000 iron atoms. So you don't have to actually have an infinite number of degrees of freedom to, in practice, have this be true. So this is, again, not something I was going to talk about. This is kind of a not taking us to Goldstone bosons, but it does underline that there's subtleties in comparing these. It's not like this is all one big Hilbert space. The amplitude for evolving from here to here, they're unitarily inequivalent spaces, and that kind of is going to come up in the Goldstone boson story I'm going to tell you about in a second. But before I tell you that, have I said everything I need to say here? Or? Yeah, there's two statements. So this tunneling story, when you have lots of degrees of freedom, they all have to tunnel at some level. And so that says you now have the option of being here or here as opposed to being symmetric. So that's an option that you have, but it doesn't tell you what you choose. And then the statement is that systems cluster. That's a physical principle that we build in because that's what they seem to do. And then that tells you that they chose, that they actually sit here and they don't sit in distributed states that are kind of seeing different vacua all at once. Because if you did choose a state like that, it wouldn't have had the property that correlation functions would factorize. So if you that doesn't mean you can't entangle something and try and make that happen, but that's not what the ground states normally choose for themselves if you set up a system.
So it's related to the Hamiltonian being constructed out of the field?
I think they're related in the sense that this is a statement about what the state is, but then what you demand about your dynamics is that property of clustering is preserved in time, and then that having the Hamiltonian be a sum of different positions is what's going into having this clustering be preserved as you evolve in time.
I think I heard that the Lagrangian means to go around that circle is infinite. Yeah.
The what is infinite?
The energy that the.
No, there's zero energy cost. So these are all.
Okay, but the kinetic energy.
Kinetic energy for whom?
For the Hamiltonian system.
No, I'd say that the energy for all these things is zero, let's say.
No, I think the potential energy is zero, but the kinetic energy is infinite. Because just, for example, it's like particles, you know, stars from that point to go. So the potential is zero, but it needs a velocity, yeah?
So when you say kinetic energy, you mean like phi dot squared. So I agree with you that if I give you a field theory.
So as long as it gets non-zero, so when you integrate it over the you know, infinite space, so it is infinite.
I agree with you if your statement is that if you give me a time-dependent field configuration that's not localized in space, this would be infinite.
Then the vacuum wants to move in that circle, so it needs a velocity, something like phi.
Oh, you're saying if you actually tried to shoot something around the make it go around like that, that would no longer be the vacuum. And then there would be some energy, part of which would be kinetic. That's right. But I'm saying that the vacuum is you sit at the bottom here. Another vacuum is you sit at the bottom here.
But I mean, the vacuum in this process does not change, because if it wants to change, then it needs, you know, the point that to be non-zero, and then the.
No, there's absolutely no, there's no energy cost between this one and this one and this one and this one and this one. It's not, this sitting here, this sitting here, this sitting here, they all have the same energy. And I think you're thinking about, if I started off with a configuration where I tried to make the field roll around the bottom, that's not the vacuum.
It rolls like smidge of, you know, a little, then it means...
As long as it's rolling, it's not the vacuum. Because the vacuum, if you minimize the energy, remember the whole energy was that, there was a grad phi squared term, and then there's a potential energy term. The way you minimize the vacuum, the lowest energy was, since they're all positive, you minimize them by making them all minimum. You make that one minimum by making it zero. That one's minimum by making it zero, so it's a constant. And then that one's minimized by minimizing the potential. So all three of those things had to be true to be the vacuum. And if you relax any of them, then you're no longer the vacuum. And you're saying that you could do that for very, very low energy, and it's true. You can get arbitrarily close by having it go very, very slowly.
If I wanted to move the vacuum from that point, so then I needed to spend an infinite energy to do that.
No, I think what you're saying is that the ways that you're imagining doing it would be an infinite amount of energy. And I think what you're thinking is you take the whole field, you leave the gradient zero, make it a constant to make that small, and then you make that whole thing have a kinetic energy. And then you're saying you pay for the price by having a big volume here. But let me not do that. So I'll pay a little bit of price here. I'll have it be a little region that'll then go to zero. And so now I'll pay a little bit of gradient energy, but now I'm no longer getting an infinite amount of this. That has to be lower energy than what you were thinking. So that's a lower energy state, but it's still not the vacuum. Right? So it's the statement I was making was that these things, even though the ground states are the same energy, it's not like there's a unitary operator that takes you from here to here. And you might object to that because G should have been the unitary operator that took you from there to there. And so what I'm about to say is that for a field theory, this G is actually a subtle thing because it's not like G takes you from here to here. G acting on states here give you they're not normalized anymore. So the evolution, the reason that currents are useful is that these G's are often not well defined in the field theory, and so you can set up things that look reasonable in quantum mechanics will become nonsense in the field theory. And so, but almost always you can translate it into a statement involving the current, which makes sense. So this kind of a thing always makes sense for the field theory because it's a local thing, that the commutator was giving you something local at a specific position. So even if G doesn't make sense at the quantum mechanical level for field theory, the commutator of Q with things does make sense. But Q itself doesn't have to take you to a reasonable state. So let me make that point. I wasn't going to do it in this order, but let me make that point now. So what I'm saying is that here's a weird thing. So let's just calculate the norm of the state. We'll take a vacuum, one of those guys sitting on the Mexican hat. We'll operate on it with Q, and we'll get a new state. So we'll call that chi. And let's just calculate the norm of chi. So that would be, you know, omega Q Q omega. But Q in a field theory is the integral of J naught d3x. So let's write this. We got omega Q integral d3x. Let me write the integral outside here. J naught of x and t omega. But I also know in a field theory how to write the position and time dependence of an operator. For any operator, you know, I can always write that as e to the I p dot x minus I h t, and let me call this u. U dagger. Right, there's some unitary thing, x t, zero x t. So I can make the position dependence explicit here by putting in those operators. But I also know that the vacuum is translation invariant, right? So this is just the vacuum. And I know that Q commutes with time translations. I have, as long as my symmetry commutes with momentum and energy, which it typically does, then I can commute these guys. And then it's also true that U acting on one of these was a dagger. Let me write that one a dagger. Let's write it that way. Sorry? Like acute remission. You just want that quarter, right? So I can change the order here for free because Q commits with U. And then again, this is just omega. So what I've shown you is that this is the integral d3x of omega Q J naught of zero omega. Nothing here depends on x. So this integral is just the volume of spacetime, which is infinite, right? So that shows you that the if I just take Q operated on the ground state, I'm getting some state which is not normalizable. So I'm not just getting a state that's just a little bit further down. Naively, what you should have been getting was, if I started here, I should have been ending up here and getting the state that describes that place. And although in quantum mechanics that would have been true, in field theory it's not true because the many degrees of freedom makes the normalizability of states not a given. So because of that, what we're not, you know, the argument I want to make is, you remember for the toy model, what we did is we knew the massless state was, it was massless and it was weakly coupled, and the way we showed that was we wrote the original field phi as a modulus times a phase, and then so we designed it so that the light field was the phase of the complex field. And so if we had made it constant, that was just a symmetry transformation. And so it had to be true that the Lagrangian didn't depend on the light field at all unless it varied in position as a function of position and time. And that was a way of seeing that it could never appear in the potential. And so the logic was we just tried to make the light field by taking the vacuum and then just doing a symmetry transformation on it. And that should have caused no energy. So now if we do a space-time dependent symmetry transformation, that's no longer a symmetry because the symmetry normally assumes the parameters are constant. Then that'll be a very low energy state because it'll become zero energy when the state is not varying at all in space-time. And Goldstone's theorem, which is what I'm starting to do, is that statement that there's always, when you have a symmetry that's spontaneously broken like this, a global symmetry, there's always a state which is arbitrarily close to the vacuum corresponding to doing a symmetry transformation that's not exactly with constant parameter, but it's got a very slowly varying parameter. You can make that arbitrarily low energy. And the reason you go through that exercise and you don't just do the symmetry transformation is that the symmetry transformation is really not so well defined for the states. So what we're going to do is phrase everything in terms of the currents, because the currents are well defined, even though so that if I take the current and act on the vacuum with it, I'll get a state which makes sense. Whereas if I did the charge, I wouldn't get something which made sense because it's this integral that's the problem. The integral wasn't a problem here, because this commutator was a delta function, so you're never doing the integral. And so these commutators are making sense, but the action of these operators like Q on states are kind of fishy. Let me use this board here. Okay. So now Goldstone's theorem says one more thing I want to say, I guess, spontaneous symmetry breaking. What we normally would do, so what we want to say, we can't talk about this in a field theory, so we need a better way of saying that we know that symmetry breaking happened. So for field theory, instead of using this as our criterion, because of that argument, so what we'll do is we'll assume that there's a field that transforms under the symmetry, which has got a non-zero expectation value in the vacuum, like we did in the classical in the toy model. So we need another a better criterion or spontaneous symmetry breaking. So what we'll do is we'll assume there exists a field phi and psi such that the variation of phi, let's say variation of psi is phi. And the expectation value of phi in the vacuum is unequal to zero. So these fields would be what you'd call an order parameter. And the reason you're doing this is that you're trying to ask this, what you're trying to demand is that this is true, but you're trying to avoid that issue over there that this is actually not very well defined. And so the purpose of this is that this excludes the option where if Q on the ground state is zero, then that problem is not a problem. Then the ground state is actually invariant, and then these Qs can be well defined. But this property with this transformation rule will forbid the option where Q on the ground state is zero. That's the point of this choice. So before I do the Goldstone's theorem, so claim. If Q on the ground state equals zero, so no spontaneous, that's to say there's no spontaneous symmetry breaking, that implies that if phi is the variation of some other thing under the symmetry, then the ground state of phi has to be zero. So if this is not zero, then that means that this cannot be zero. And then so that's why this is used as a diagnostic that the ground state was not invariant. So omega phi omega not zero implies this is not cannot be the invariant, which implies spontaneous symmetry breaking. So this is a sufficient condition for spontaneous symmetry breaking. And to see that this is true, what we can do is just write this out. So we know that delta phi is I times Q commuted with phi. So let's just write that out, IQ phi minus I phi Q. And so now I take the expectation value of, psi. And the assumption is that this is what phi is equal to, right? So that means that the expectation value of phi is equal to I times cube psi minus I times psi Q. So you see that if Q annihilates the vacuum, it's going to, one way or another, it's going to hit a vacuum here. So if this is zero, then this has to be zero. So Q equals zero implies omega Q equals zero implies omega phi omega equals zero. So having said that, I can state Goldstone's theorem. they're both in the sense that the what this is really saying is a symmetry, if it doesn't leave a field invariant, there will be some. Normally, it's a finite dimensional representation of for most symmetries you talk about. So there'd be some finite number of fields that are related to each other by the symmetry. And that whole multiplet, you'd say, is the order parameter. So if we'd been talking about rotations, and we're talking about a ferromagnet, then spin would be the order parameter. That's Sx, Xy, and Sz. They're rotating into each other, but the whole vector is the order parameter. Well, that's the normally what happens when you set these things up in a field theory. If you have a transformation rule, the fields will either be invariant or they'll transform, and then if they're going to transform, they'll be in a finite dimensional representation. You have to distinguish between linear transformations and nonlinear transformations, which we're going to kind of come to in a bit. But there's going to be some class of fields which vary into one another under the symmetry rules. And normally, in all examples of interest, normally, but I don't know if this is going to be true of nature always. But in the cases that you normally talk about, there's a finite number of fields that are transforming. So what you can just do is you can take any field in that thing and vary it. And you didn't care what psi was. All you cared was that there was something who varies into the thing that's got a non-zero expectation value. And so, I think this is, in condensed matter physics, for a long time, this was kind of the way they thought about matter, was that you could just characterize things in terms of order parameters and symmetries being broken. And they're stepping away from that now. So whether this is always the way you can organize all your thinking about everything, I wouldn't hang my hat on. But this is the operational way in which you identify spontaneous symmetry breaking in field theories. For the symmetries, the internal symmetries normally that you hit, and the space-time symmetries, this is kind of the way you do it. And in that case, there's always a finite dimensional multiplet, and you take the field that's got an expectation value, and there's always somebody who varies into it. That reminded me, there's something I forgot to say. You know, what were the two consequences? Why do we care so much about spontaneous symmetry breaking in a field theory? And it's related to why we cared about symmetries. So symmetries did two things for us, right? Symmetries had the property that if I label states with a conserved charge, then those quantities are conserved. But it also had the property that if I had two states related by the symmetry, so Q psi, then they have the same energy. So in a field theory, typically the spontaneous symmetry is breaking is coming up because you're trying to ruin this property. Because normally this says that all states come to you in multiplets that are organized by the symmetry. And so if you think you have a symmetry in your problem, the way to tell is look at all your energy eigenstates and see if they organize themselves into multiplets of what you think the symmetry was. And of course, you know that there are examples where, and this is a ferromagnet, I guess, would be a simple one, where states are not being, once the ground state is not invariant under the symmetry, it's no longer true that the particle states are satisfying this property. So in a field theory, the issue that you're trying to, what normally happens in a field theory is that a symmetry comes to you acting on the field. So someone gives you something like there's a symmetry, you know, U field, U dagger is equal to the new field, or I guess Q with the field is equal to delta field. So you're handed that as being the symmetry transformation rule, and you'd like to make inferences about states. And so this normally means that there's some statement, the fields are given to you as sum over modes of creation annihilation operators. And so this turns into a statement about the creation annihilation operators that I, Q, say on some creation operator, is equal to some other creation operator. So say you have two fields that are related by symmetry, then this would say that the corresponding creation and annihilation operators are also related by this in the same way by the symmetry. So they would organize themselves into multiplets. But what you like to make is states about the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. And so the in a field theory, those particle states say, let's say chi is B acting on the ground state, and let's say that psi is A acting on the ground state. If we want to make this kind of inference about particles coming to us in multiplets, and we try to repeat the argument we make here, then what happens is that you'd say that the, I'll use this property, so I'll use that chi is I times Q A star minus A star Q. So if I take this first term here, this is I times Q, and A star on omega is what I would call psi. But I also have this term here, which is minus I AK star Q on omega. So if I knew that this was equal to this, then the argument that I made for quantum mechanics would be true, and we'd know that they have the same energy because Q commutes with the Hamiltonian. So I hit the Hamiltonian, it goes right through Q and gives me this. But this is the new thing. And so the statement, the precise statement is that if Q on the ground state is zero, i.e. the ground state is invariant, then it's true that states that are related by this, you know, the particle states that are built above that ground state by creation operators are related in the way that you assumed in quantum mechanics, and they will have the same energy. So then particles will fall into multiplets that are related by the symmetry. But if this is not zero, which is what happens when you spontaneously break symmetries, it will no longer be true that particles that were related by the symmetry, particles that were naively related by the symmetry, they won't necessarily have come in multiplets. And so if you spontaneously break rotational invariants, you will not expect to find particle states organized in multiplets of the rotation group, say. So so we need chi equals I cubed psi to conclude the energy of chi is equal to energy of psi if Q is a symmetry. So spontaneous symmetry breaking, which is to say Q not being equal to zero, is of interest precisely because it ruins this inference. It ruins the inference that particles come in degenerate multiplets. So if you believe that supersymmetry is a true theory of the world, you would have had to believe that bosons and fermions come with the same energy. And for relativistic particles, that means they have the same mass, because they take their momentum to have both be zero. And a way out of that would be if the vacuum is not supersymmetric. And so that's kind of why you care a lot about it, spontaneous breaking of supersymmetry. So the just because it's a solution of the equations of motion doesn't mean that it's a solution of the solutions to the equations of motion. All right, so let me state the theorem. So Goldstone's theorem. So the claim is, if you have spontaneous symmetry breaking in that sense, so if you know, omega phi omega is not zero for phi the variation of something, then there exists a state, call it G, for which the matrix element G current ground state is not zero. And this being not zero tells you a lot about the properties of G. So consequence of this being not zero is that G has satisfies its energy. If you take the limit, the momentum goes to zero of its energy, that goes to zero. So it's gapless. So in a relativistic theory, that would be massless. If you know what the symmetry is, then you know various quantum numbers of the current. So if this is a normal internal symmetry, so for internal symmetry, G is spinless. For supersymmetry, G is spin half. And so on. All those things are coming from the fact that this matrix element is not zero. You know what the spin and the energy of the ground state is. You know what it is. You know how these things commute with translations and time translations and rotations. And so then you can infer what this has to properties this has to have. So this is kind of the punchline property that Goldstone guarantees for you. And the argument for this is, and kind of what this is almost the statement that this G is the thing you got by doing a symmetry transformation of the vacuum. Because that would have been, moving the vacuum would have been, in principle, Q acting on the vacuum. And then you'd ask for the new state to have a non-zero overlap, so that you'd ask for G with Q to be non-zero in the vacuum. So if Q does not annihilate the vacuum, it gives you something, G is that something. That's kind of morally what you'd want to say. But you don't say that because of all these subtleties about Q is not actually very well defined acting on states. So instead you say Q was the integral of the current, and you say that this current has to act on the vacuum and give you something non-zero. If this was always giving you things that were zero, then Q would also have to give you zero when it hit the vacuum. So that's kind of where, that's why people focus on the current here rather than the charge. But because it's almost the charge, it's going to, these properties that follow from this being non-zero, like the energy being arbitrarily small, are coming from the fact that when you integrate the current, you're getting something which is generating a symmetry, and so you should be getting states that are not differing in energy. So you're getting as close to the statement you would have made in quantum mechanics as you can. So since I ran out of time there, sorry, the first part took longer than I thought, let me leave that statement and then I'll come back to how you get from here to here. I'll do this as an example because that's the classic example. And then what I really want to do is to take the case of if you have a bunch of Goldstone bosons and they're scattering with one another, what you could do is you can calculate how they scatter by looking at correlation functions of these currents. And that's what people used to do in the old days. They look at correlation functions of conserved currents, which had to be there because they had symmetries. And then the algebra of the currents is telling you something about the scattering properties of the Gs. And that's the hard way to work. An easier way to work is to directly write down, once you know these things are light and they have symmetry properties, the better way to approach it is to write down the effective field theory for it. There has to be some effective field theory where you're at the low energy theory will include those things, possibly other things. But if there's symmetries constraining that, you can build those in with no loss of generality by identifying what the field theory is that incorporates all the symmetry properties. And so the trick will be to identify in a general way the transformation rules that Goldstone bosons will have under the symmetry that tell you that they have that property in particular. And there's a general solution to that problem, which is what the afternoon class will be. Okay?
So when you break supersymmetry, you have to get massless fermions?
You're guaranteed that there's one massless fermion, yeah.
And then how do they get around that there aren't massless
fermions? Oh, so what'll happen also is that, this is for global symmetries. So if you had global symmetries, there would have to just be a massless fermion. And you have to hope that it was weakly interacting like a neutrino or something, or weaker, that you wouldn't see it. But in practice, supersymmetry can't be global because it's two supersymmetries is a translation. And we know that translations are gauged because gravity is the gauge theory of that. So we know that we're living in a gauge theory of gravity, which means that we had to also be living in a gauge theory of supersymmetry. So there has to be a gauge fermion for supersymmetry if it's true. And so what happens in that case is if we had had a local symmetry, a local internal symmetry, what would have happened is that the Goldstone boson that could have been there gets eaten by the gauge boson to give you the missing longitudinal spin state. So that the massless spin one particle for an unbroken symmetry becomes the massive spin one particle of the broken symmetry by eating the Goldstone boson that had to be there. That's what happens. That's the Higgs mechanism. So what happens in the gravity case, the supersymmetry case, is that the massless spin 3/2 particle that was the gauge fermion for supersymmetry eats the massive the Goldstone fermion to give you the remaining two spin states you need to get a massive spin 3/2 particle.
Oh.
And then that couples gravitationally. So that has to be there. And it's a question of how heavy it is. But it wouldn't be a stretch to have missed it because it's coupling gravitationally. But it's always there in any supergravity. Yeah. You knew you had to break the symmetry because you knew that the particles are not coming to you in Bose-Fermi pairs. So if the gravitino was there, it had to be massive. And the question is how massive. So that depends on exactly how you break the symmetry. And so then people argue about that.
But if you didn't have gravity, then you should get a massless fermion.
Yeah, if you didn't have gravity, then it would be massless. And it's true that in the limit that if you take even when you do have gravity, if you take the coupling to be weak enough, it starts to break into the two pieces again, just like in a spin one case. If you take the couplings to be weak enough, it starts to look like the Goldstone boson separately from the spin, massless spin one guy. So an example of that is in the standard model, if you look at the decay rate of the Higgs, look at the decay rate of the Higgs into, supposing the Higgs was, it turns out it's not heavy enough, but supposing it had been heavy enough they could decay into W bosons, then you might have thought that because W bosons couple with the gauge coupling constant, that if I made the gauge coupling constant arbitrarily small, that the whole rate would go to zero. And that doesn't happen, actually. What happens is that the rate into the transverse polarizations of the W boson do go to zero, but the rate into the longitudinal polarization doesn't go to zero because it's actually being controlled by the scalar self-interaction, because really that was a Higgs goes into a Higgs. That's like two scalars decaying into each other. And so what happens in that limit, if you make the gauge coupling very, very weak, is that this mixing between the spin one particle and the spinless particle is starting to undo itself. Yeah.
So what does that mean physically? Like, conserved charge means that conserved current means that you charge, you have to physically take it out of the of your area.
Right.
So what does that imply about if you just have to describing your system?
I'm not sure this is what you're asking, but I'm not going to have time to get to fluids. That was one of the topics, but that's what fluids are. So if you take fluids, you know, there you if you think of what the Navier-Stokes equations are, you're saying that you've got some interacting gas, and if you try to track the atoms, that's happening very fast. If you want to know if you paint them all red, or these ones are red, these are blue, and you ask how they mix, that's a complicated problem that actually happens on a fast time scale. But if you're asking on long time scales, and if all you ask is, if you choose to track not the redness or blueness of atoms, but where the energy is, then that'll be something which has to move slowly, because if you want to move energy from here to here, you actually have to physically move it from there to there. It can't just kind of rapidly, sort of microscopically diffuse over there. And so because the conserved things have to physically get moved from one region to another, those are the ones that it pays you to track in a macroscopic picture. And so that's what the Navier-Stokes equations are, right? You just take the averages of the energy momentum, and you just ask, you essentially write energy conservation in terms of the macroscopic variable. You assume that you can write it in terms of macroscopic variables like temperature. And then you say, well, if I have the energy density and flux and momentum and density and flux parameterized in a derivative expansion, and I stop at the fewest number of derivatives, and then I just impose energy conservation, which I know will have to be true in the long distance theory, I'll have to get a true result. And that is the Navier-Stokes equations, right? So so that's typically what people do when they're macroscopically. If you know nothing else, you just track the conserved things, because you know, the one thing you know about them is that for them to get from here to here, they had to actually move. So if you look at long distances, it'll be slow. And so there'll be something to talk about in your low energy limit or your long time limit, which is the analog in those cases. So in that case, notice that was not an effective Lagrangian. That was a averages of energies that you're tracking. And because in that case, in a fluid, there's nothing energetically saying that the particles that you're tracking, it wasn't that you didn't have enough energy to see them, you just didn't have enough, you know, patience. And whereas up until now, we've been excluding states that by conservation law, that if we excluded them, they stay away, because if we start off at low energies, we can't produce them physically because they don't have enough energy to. And we're relying on the conservation laws to forbid the things that we didn't include. But in a fluid situation where you've got things that are actually allowed by all the conservation laws to be trackable, and you're just choosing not to track them, then you have to kind of go back and re-ask, is there a Hamiltonian evolution? And all the things that we kind of started from are up for grabs again. But the thing that's take to the bank is conservation laws will move the conserved quantities around. So if you follow them only, then you'll get things that have to be true.